It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In a few minutes, we'll learn about community-supported art, a new way to connect the arts community with the rest of us.
First, a day in the life of a harvest camp in northern Wisconsin.
We've talked about this on the program before. It's a tribal camp in the Pinoki Hills near a proposed iron mine. It's serving as an educational site, but it's also been a symbol of opposition to the mine.
The camp is in legal limbo as Iron County and Le Coup d'Orée work to figure out its future. Meanwhile, the camp continues drawing visitors from around the state, including reporter Tegan Wendland, who went there last weekend and filed this report.
Depends on the day. Sometimes they have lots of visitors and activities. Other days, the place feels like a family home that just happens to be in the woods. Mel Gasper is a Le Coup d'Orée elder and head of what he says is more than just a camp.
It's an educational camp. It's a learning camp. It's also a healing camp for a lot of people that come out here. They get a sense of being back to nature and the easement of their mind and soul.
Those people include children who run around the camp playing with the pet rabbit, sliding down a pile of stones, driving toy trucks through the wood pile and catching bugs and frogs.
Me and my nephew like to look for frogs.
Yes, we got him.
You got him?
Wow! He's so little. Leighton, look. See something.
Cool.
More than 1,000 visitors have signed their names in the camp guest book. They buy handcrafted items like birch bark baskets, walking sticks, and traditional recipes. The money benefits the camp. Crystal Farrell of Madison is looking to buy an ironwood walking stick made by camp member Clifton Gann.
Oh my goodness, those are awesome.
Yeah, this one's 25 and this is be 30 for you.
Yeah, I like the shorter one. Tell me how you do these diamonds. Or is this natural part of the wood?
It's natural. These are knots.
There's a tarp hanging over a fire circle in the center of the camp where Gasper says people gather to talk and cook food throughout the day and night.
We sit around here. We do a lot of discussion in this area here. It's the significance of the Native people here to sit around the fire and discuss things. We do things, the Native people do things in the circle of life. And to sit around the fire is the significance of that.
Camp members lay out maps of the Pinokis and tell visitors about the proposed mine as well as the natural beauty of the place. Wildlife biologist and mine opponent Greg Jennings gives tours throughout the day to the site where Gogebic Taconite has done some exploratory drilling, about a mile or so through the woods.
We're at one of the drill sites, drill site number 8. Right now we're looking at what they left behind, which is a pipe that was drilled at an angle.
Nina Rose of Madison says she's visiting the camp because she wants to learn about the proposed mine, which she sees as a threat.
There is no way to compare the profit. There's no exchange for human life. That's the number one endangered resource, I think.
They also give tours of Tyler Forks, a river which flows through the Pinoki Range. At the end of a gravel road, visitors walk up through the forest and along the gorges and rapids, sometimes stopping to swim or listen to the river. But it's not all peace and quiet. The camp recently received a generator as a donation, which they use to power lights and charge cell phones. There are porta-potties and camp stoves. They were even given a four-wheeler recently.
Everything we have here has been donated by all the people that want to show their support and everything. We have everything here. Coolers, water, sleeping bags, food, canned foods. Meat products. We have a four burner stove over there, gas stove we haven't even used yet.
They've planted several gardens with tomatoes, peppers, lettuce, and squash. Gasper says they're not planning on going anywhere anytime soon.
We're going to stay here until the duration of whatever happens here. That's our main goal.
Tegan Wendland, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Tegan. We'll continue to follow the story of the harvest camp and the iron mine.
Now, a look at a new way to bring art into our lives. We've talked about community-supported agriculture on the show, where you subscribe to a share and get produce through the growing season. Some of you might be eating some of your share right now. Well, here's a similar idea, but for art.
It's not here in Wisconsin yet, as far as I could find out, so we reached across our western border for a little help. Laura Zabel joins us. She's Executive Director of Springboard for the Arts in St. Paul. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what is community-supported art?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's exactly what it sounds like. We took the model of community-supported agriculture, where people buy in to a farm at the beginning of the summer and then receive fresh local vegetables throughout the growing season, and adapted it to the art world. So people buy in at the beginning of the summer, and then throughout the season, they get fresh local artworks from artists and makers who live in their community. And they also get the opportunity to meet and connect with those people, understand more about the process of how those things get made, and support their local economy.
So I subscribe to one of these things. What is showing up on my doorstep or at the pickup site? What kind of things do people get?
It varies. There's about 40 programs across the country now, but here in Minnesota, in our program, you might get functional work like a ceramic cup or a special recording of a record by a local musician. You might get textile, a silk scarf, or a limited edition print, or a small original oil painting or stained glass. We've had a real variety of work in the program.
And we hear that community-supported agriculture really helps connect people to the farmers who grow their food. When you see this in practice, you touched on this briefly, do you see that community starting to form between the subscribers and the artists?
We really do, and that's really why we're doing it. Of course, people love getting the object, and that's a part of it, but our real purpose in doing it is the relationships that form between the people in the community and the artists. And I think that what we've really learned from doing it is that there are a lot of barriers in terms of knowing who is in your community, who are the artists in your community, being able to find them and sort of navigate that world. I think in the art world, we're not always so good at making that sort of open and accessible to people. And so this is a doorway, an on-ramp for people to understand who are some of the artists that live right in their community, and what is it like to be an artist, and what does that process look like. So our goal is always that people form relationships and then go on to collect or commission their work in the future, buy work from those artists independent of the CSA program.
Now, since you're the closest one of these programs, as far as I can tell, to Wisconsin, I want to get some of the history here. How long have you been doing this?
This is our fourth summer doing it, and we started the project here in the Twin Cities, Springboard for the Arts, and another organization here locally, MNArtists.org, started the project in 2010. And so this is our sort of fourth summer of doing it. It's been tremendously popular here locally. And so we wrote a toolkit for how to make a community-supported art program in your community. We share all of the sort of templates and nuts and bolts of how it works and kind of why we do it here. And people can get that toolkit, and then they can adapt it and make it authentic and work for their community. So we've seen them popping up all over the country. We do think there is going to be one coming soon in Eau Claire in Wisconsin, so that will be exciting to see. But it's really fun to see how people take the idea and adapt it and make it different and better and work for the people who live where they live.
And about how many people have started subscribing to this?
We sell 50 shares in our program. We sell out every year. It's become very popular. People always ask me, why don't you sell more shares? And I think it's part of what pushed us to write the toolkit was that we wanted other people to take the idea and do it. So rather than become the factory farm of CSAs, we decided to let other people start their own farm.
And how do you pick the artists? I mean, you mentioned it's sometimes tough to find them, but anybody who comes in the door, or do you judge it, or how does that work?
We have a jury process. So every year in the spring, we do an open call, and any artist can apply to be a part of the CSA. They propose what they'd like to do, and then we assemble a jury, both of people from the art community, and our jury always includes some people from the local food community, too. That connection to other parts of the local economy is really important to us in the program as well. And then we select 9 artists, usually from a very large pool, so it's gotten to be fairly competitive. And the artists that we select then get the money from the shareholders to support making those 50 objects. That's kind of another kind of unique part about the program is that as the artists are making their pieces, they already know that 50 people have committed to them and that they all have homes. And I think that's a thing that seems to really resonate both for the artist and the shareholders.
Oh, yeah, because when you're an artist, you're making something hoping you might sell it someday. But that's never a guarantee. Now it's kind of like the community supported agriculture. You know you've got some place to sell it. You've already sold it.
Right, you know that it's going to be in all 50 of those people's homes, and I think for the artists too, it's a way for them to reach new audiences for their work, new potential patrons and supporters of their work, and I think as a tool for artists to find new supporters or find new audiences, it's been really effective.
Talking to Laura Zabel, she's executive director of Springboard for the Arts in St. Paul, about community-supported art, this program where people subscribe and they get art delivered through the season.
And you can join in. Does this sound like fun to you? Would you like to get an art share? And if you're an artist, would you participate in this program? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
We'll continue our conversation now with Laura Zabel. She's executive director of Springboard for the Arts in St. Paul. We're talking about community-supported arts programs where you can buy a share and get art showing up throughout, say, the summer or a few months. They're doing this in St. Paul. Nobody's doing it in Wisconsin quite yet. She says Eau Claire might be on the verge. What do you think of this? Would you buy a share of art you haven't seen yet? Or if you're an artist, would you like to participate in this? If you're one of the people in Eau Claire, by the way, who's trying to get this started, love to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Laura, on a wider level, is this part of an effort to connect art to our everyday lives? I think a lot of times we have the sense that there's art over there in the museum and the rich people have it and the rest of us maybe stop and visit every now and then, but it's not really part of our lives.
Exactly. I think much in the same way that community-supported agriculture is about helping people really connect to the people who grow their food and really understand that process and how it fits into the local economy and their local community, we really think that the goal for community-supported art is the same thing. And I would say, you know, really all of Springboard's work is about how artists connect to the everyday lives of their community, how they participate in their community, and how we build value for the contributions that artists make.
And I wonder, with the community-supported art, sometimes with the agriculture version of it, there's always some stuff that I don't like, that fennel is going straight probably into the compost. What happens?
Yeah.
Is it a concern for people before they subscribe? Like, what if I get this thing that I think is really ugly and I don't want to put it out there?
People always ask me, what's the kale?
Wait, I love the kale. Forget
right.
The kale. That's awesome.
I love the kale as well. And we really encourage people. We always say that participating in community-supported art is as much about the experience as it is about the object. And that it's certainly not our expectation that you're going to fall in love with all 9 pieces. We, of course, hope that you fall in love with some of them, and we think everybody does. But we really encourage people to think about who you might gift that to. You know, the nice thing is that unlike kale or fennel, it won't go bad. So you could save it for the holidays and give it to someone that you think might be more appreciative or more in tune with that piece. I will also say that we sort of intentionally pick a group of 9 artists, some of whom I think are very comfortable, you know, a pottery mug or those kind of things that are functional, and some of whom are kind of designed to push people's idea of maybe what art is or what kind of art they like. And I think people really enjoy that. I think they do enjoy the idea that they're going to get some things that they probably wouldn't pick out on their own, and that kind of it is a part of the experience.
I'm guessing you've heard some love stories, too. Tell me about some of the things that people were surprised by that they got that they just really fell in love with in their art basket.
Yeah, you know, one year we had an artist who made these wonderful little sculptures that were little seeds that had little thorns inserted in them. They were, you know, very small, but but very detailed sculptural objects and very pokey. And I think a lot of people initially looked at that and kind of thought, oh, dear, what am I going to do with this? but I know that a lot of people have really, really relished that object and found a very special place for it in their home. We also have a lot of really great success stories of artists who made pieces for the Community Supported Art Project and then got commissions from the shareholders. One of the stories I love to tell is about an artist who made a stained glass piece, and then one of our collaborators on the project was visiting one of the shareholders' homes and walked in, and they had commissioned four more stained glass pieces
wow.
from the same artist, all in a series. And that's really what we're hoping happens, is that you find one or two pieces that you really love, and that you meet that artist at the pickup event, and that you go on to really have a relationship with them and follow their work and hopefully buy their work.
We'll go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Frank in Kenosha on the line. Frank, hi there.
Hi, how are you? It's actually Franklin, but I'm just calling. I'm very intrigued by the program, and I think it would be a very interesting thing to have in this area. I'm an artist myself, and I'd like to get art, so I like it on both ends, actually. But the one thing I didn't hear covered, unless I just miss it, is, like, in your particular program, how much does it cost to, like, become one of these 50 people or one of these people that buy into the program?
Frank, that's exactly the kind of question a radio host should ask. Thank you for calling in with that. Laura, about how much does that cost?
Here in the Twin Cities, our program is $300 for the shareholders, and then each of the participating artists gets a $1,000 commission. So, and a piece that's really important to us is that the artists know going in that they're going to get the $1,000 and that they propose a project that they think they can do for that amount of money. So that piece is really important to us. And I will say across the country, the sort of price point varies. We talk a lot with partners as they're developing their programs across the country, and the sort of loose guideline we give them is you want the price point to be high enough that you can say with some certainty to the participating artist that people are going to be able to buy their work going forward, and low enough that people are willing to take the risk and that you keep it accessible, and there really is a program that's about building new interest and new connections to the community and not a way for collectors to sort of snatch up additional pieces or something like that.
Thanks for the call, Frank. And Frank mentioned he's an artist. He would be interested in being a participant on the share side, too. Do you get some people like that where the artists are also subscribing to get the other stuff?
It's true. We do. And, you know, one of the great examples of how having all these programs all over the country have really helped each other and informed each other, there was a program in Philadelphia, and they had this brilliant idea where instead of having the artists make 50 pieces, they had the artists make 59 pieces. So all of the participating artists also got a share and sort of built that community among the nine artists. And that's an idea now that we've rolled back into our program here at home and included in the toolkit now and talk about a lot. So it's a really good example of how letting an idea kind of spread and letting people adapt it gets you a lot better ideas back.
All right, we'll go back to the phones with Krista in Spring Green. Krista, hi.
Hi.
Did you have a question?
I do. Thank you for bringing this topic up. I'm an artist, and I am wondering who does the administration of such a program, and I'm wondering how I could incorporate that into my life, my busy life, how you incorporate it into yours. And if you spread that out among the artists or how that works.
Yeah, on a practical level, who takes care of business?
Here in the Twin Cities, Springboard for the Arts and MNArtist.org are two organizations whose missions are really about making connections between artists and community, so we handle all of the back-end administration. Across the country, it really varies. Some of them are self-organizing groups of artists or cooperatively owned galleries. It really, we tell people, really helps to have, you know, two or three people to spread the work around. It's not, you know, a tremendously administratively heavy program, but you do want to be able to take good care of your artists and your shareholders and organize some fun events. But it can work a lot of different ways. And we kind of, in the toolkit, it has sort of little mini job descriptions of all of the roles that it takes to get your CSA moving.
And if someone like Krista or anyone else out there thinks, hey, maybe this is something I want to try to start, where do they go to get that toolkit you've mentioned, to get that starting instruction?
You can go right to our website, which is springboardforthearts.org, and there's actually a link right on the homepage right now that'll take you directly to all of the information. And there's also a map there of all the programs that we know of across the country, so you can kind of look close to where you live or maybe where your family lives and see if there's one there already.
All right. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
That was Laura Zabel. She's Executive Director of Springboard for the Arts in St. Paul. If you decide you try to start this, let us know. I'd be interested to know if you try to get the ball rolling out there somewhere.
Coming up, an effort to allow prayer in local government meetings with President Obama and congressional Republicans on board. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn why the city of Seymour is considered the birthplace of the hamburger.
But first, we're talking about what some are calling the biggest religious freedom case the Supreme Court has seen in the last 50 years.
At issue is whether or not the town of Greece in upstate New York can open their monthly town hall meeting with a Christian prayer. This week, members of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, most of them Republican, filed briefs with the High Court in support of relaxing the laws on prayers at government meetings.
Lawyers for the Obama administration have also petitioned the court on behalf of the town. The U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the town's prayer policy endorses a Christian point of view, making it unconstitutional.
The Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal this fall. Derek Hicks is with us now. He's assistant professor of religion and culture at Wake Forest University's School of Divinity. He's the author of Reclaiming Spirit in the Black Faith Tradition. Derek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the Supreme Court's going to take a look on this. If they rule in favor, in the town's favor, allow prayers before the government meetings, what are the implications of that?
Well, the implications religiously for this country are broad and sweeping, it would seem to me. On some level, what this issue is about is how the United States as a nation has utilized religion and the impact of religious faith and culture on American life, American culture, and American politics. So this debate, on some level, forces us to contend yet again or perpetually with whether or not the United States was founded as a Christian nation. And here I'm reminded of the great work co-authored by Nathan Hatch, who's actually the president of Wake Forest University, along with Mark Knoll and George Marsden, entitled The Search for a Christian America, that while Christian values have been absent from American history and culture, there have been some Christian influences. And so we've been debating for years the extent of those Christian influences.
Well, and then there's always a challenge to this sort of thing by people often who aren't Christian. I think a Jewish or atheist saying, hey, if you do this, we're left out. How does that fit in?
Right. I think the takeaway from this, or at least the starting point of this cultural and political conversation, really centers on those two sides. That on one side, on one level of this, the issue is driven in part by assumptions regarding the impact of one particular religion, in this case Christianity, on the United States. So for the Christian, for those who would be proponents of Christianity and its influence on our culture and society, it is for them a confirmation of the historical idea, some would argue the historical myth, that this is in fact a Christian nation. For them, it is an issue of religious freedom in the sense that they are practicing the religion of, or at least primarily endorsed by, the nation state. But for those who you mentioned, the non-Christian, the atheist, the Jewish adherent, the Muslim adherent, such freedoms are at the heart of the issue, because for them, this debate does not open the door for further religious freedom and tolerance. Rather, it closes the door for any religious practices that are not Christian. This would be kind of a prima facie violation of the First Amendment ban on the quote-unquote establishment of religion. So for them, and especially with respect to the separation of church and state, rather than simply narrowing the distance between the nation state and organized religion, one religion, in this case Christianity, becomes perched, as it were, on top of the nation state in matters of law, justice, or adjudication, again, in violation of the First Amendment. So this is a very significant issue.
But looking at it in at this particular thing, it's, you know, a monthly town meeting, or in another case, it might be a graduation prayer or something like that. These are pretty small things. Do we put too much weight on them? Why do they become such a hot button issue?
Right. I'm not so sure that we put too much weight on them, especially given the diversity of religious expression in our country, right? That on some level, what this speaks, in this particular case, what it spoke to a person of Jewish faith and an atheist, is it revealed to them an endorsement of one religion over other religions, especially when we're talking about, in some cases, inviting in a Christian minister to pray the prayer. I'm not sure if that was in this case, but in another case, in a similar case. But the issue for them becomes, okay, who rules the day as it relates to religious freedom here? And it still seems, even though the White House has said this is not considered an endorsement, I think that's a slippery slope, or an endorsement of one religion over others. I think that's a slippery slope, because for those who are not Christian, it still seems to them to be not just an endorsement, but a forcing of their ideals to align with Christian norms and values.
From the Christian side, they're saying, we are a community that is maybe mostly predominantly Christian. We want to, you know, exercise our personal beliefs, acknowledge the identity of our Christian faith, not just at home, not just at church, but in a public setting like a government meeting, like a graduation. Are we saying no to them?
Well, that becomes the sticky issue, especially when you mention a government meeting. If, in fact, we are talking about meetings or gatherings that are endorsed by the state, by the nation state, we run the risk of tampering with the whole First Amendment issue of not endorsing one religion over another. And so for them, it becomes an issue of whether or not their ideals, their norms, given that this is a majority Christian nation, are being given the type of sway they feel it should be. And I think that's a logical debate. I think it's a worthy debate and conversation to have. But at the heart of this issue is whether or not the government is in play in kind of offering normative ideas around religion, in this case around Christianity, and that's a debate that needs to be discussed.
Now, this is an issue that united in separate court filings Republicans in Congress and President Obama and the White House. I know you're here to talk about religion mainly, and not an expert on politics, but what do you make of this?
Well, it's something that the left and the GOP can align on some level, but I'm still kind of working that out on my own. I think the Obama administration has been an administration that wants to promote freedoms on many different levels that have been denied folks in this country. So from that standpoint, I get it. And it's easy to see why in this particular debate around Christianity, why those on the right would be in alignment, because those on the right tend to be those who align with evangelical Christianity in this country. And let's be clear here, evangelical Christianity kind of rules the day in terms of how we understand Christianity in this country. So I find it interesting, this so-called alignment around this issue, but I don't think we're at the end of this. I think it's as it plays itself out, we'll see some of those lines drawn yet again.
Derek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Derek Hicks, Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture at Wake Forest University's School of Divinity.
Coming up, we'll learn why Seymour is the home of the hamburger. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, the city of Seymour, Wisconsin, is celebrating their annual Burger Fest. This year's theme is a quarter century of quarter-pound burgers.
Seymour is the birthplace of the hamburger, depending on who you talk to, and they celebrate accordingly with this festival each and every year.
Today, we're talking to John Steltz, who is Hamburger Charlie for Seymour. John, thanks for being with us. Now, why is Seymour considered the home of the hamburger?
Seymour is considered the home of the hamburger because back in 1885... A young man of 15 years old named Charlie Negrin decided at the Outagamie County Fair to take a meatball, flatten the meatball, and put it in between two slices of bread so people could walk around and look at the exhibits and visit the animal barns and things like that and enjoy their meatball now made into a hamburger.
So he lives on in legend, I hear.
Yes, he does live on in legend, and there have been a few Hamburger Charlies over the years here in Seymour. Because we are the home of the hamburger, there's actually a statue of Hamburger Charlie right downtown Seymour on the festival grounds where we will be having Burger Fest here tomorrow. And each year we have a gentleman like myself dress up as Hamburger Charlie used to dress up and go around and greet people and welcome people to Seymour for Burger Fest.
So what does he mean to Seymour? It seems like, if I recall correctly, there's a huge statue of him just right on the main drag there.
There is a huge statue of Hamburger Charlie. And what does it mean to Seymour? Well, when I was first asked about if I was interested in becoming Hamburger Charlie, I thought, wow, this is exciting. What an honor that I would even be thought of to represent. And I went to bed that night, and as I was laying in bed having trouble falling asleep, all I could think about was how Hamburger Charlie, not John Steltz, but how Hamburger Charlie is almost more important than the mayor of the town. So
wow.
after some strong consideration, I decided it would be a great opportunity to help give back to our wonderful community in Seymour and to represent Seymour and Burger Fest as home of the hamburger and take on the character of Hamburger Charlie.
Why is he more important than the mayor?
Well, because everybody identifies Seymour as the home of the hamburger and identifies Hamburger Charlie as being a staple of that town. And so I think that there are many, many times where, you know, that this is an important position held because we're welcoming people from all over the country into Seymour for Burger Fest to celebrate the home of the hamburger. And we need that liaison. We need that Hamburger Charlie and to welcome these people in and to make them comfortable. And really, I mean, when you talk about history, you're talking about something that this community, that this state values, and Hamburger Charlie is the face of that. And not only was Charlie Negrin the originator of it, but Hamburger Charlie continues on that legend as the face of this wonderful invention and this wonderful history we have right here in our state. So that is kind of important.
Do you have responsibilities throughout the year, or is it just Burger Fest is the big moment for you?
Well, Burger Fest is the big moment, and one of my concerns when I was deciding to represent Seymour and be Hamburger Charlie, one of my concerns was I have a young family, and I wanted to do it right, and I didn't want to be missing out on what my kids were doing, but yet I wanted to be able to do this right for our community. And Burger Fest is the big moment, and leading up to Burger Fest is somewhat time-consuming here and there. But I can adjust my schedule, and I can make plans, and as long as I'm given enough time to plan, I usually can accommodate most situations where Hamburger Charlie is needed.
Who decides who's going to be Hamburger Charlie, and how were you chosen?
Well, there is a, you know, a big secret board of members that gather around, you know, I'm certain campfire and so forth, and they throw names in a hat and they pull one out, and no, I'm just kidding. but the process, there were applications. I think there were a few people who wanted to be Hamburger Charlie. I was asked by one of the board members. The Home of the Hamburger is actually a group of people in Seymour that put on the Burger Fest and everything else that surrounds Burger Fest and does a lot for our community. And I was approached by one of the board members who asked if I would be interested in doing it. And as I said, it took some time and some consideration to say absolutely yes, I'll do it, because I have other commitments in my life. But I think you need somebody who is, you know, willing to talk with people, who's willing to welcome people into Seymour, who's willing to embrace the history of the invention of the hamburger. And I think that you have to have someone who's comfortable, you know, talking with the media and things like that. And I think that because of what I do in my job as a teacher and my involvement in the community besides the Home of the Hamburger, I think that led them to my door, and eventually I accepted. And you know, and this is my second year now being the Hamburger Charlie for Burger Fest.
Hmm. Well, I have to ask you this. There's another community that claims to be the home of the hamburger. I'm sure you get this question a lot. Athens, Texas claims to also have invented the hamburger there. A man named Fletcher Davis apparently did so, according to them. Is there Hamburger Fletcher, and do you guys have to duke it out once in a while?
I've never had the opportunity to duke it out, and considering the fact that they're from Texas, you know, it might be a high noon showdown sometime. Although, I would be willing to duke it out on the grill. I mean, if they're interested in a high noon showdown, maybe it's fire up two grills and see who can make the best hamburger. but all kidding aside, I mean, Seymour is the home of the hamburger. It's recognized as the home of the hamburger. The Wisconsin State Legislature a few years ago proclaimed Seymour, Wisconsin as the home of the hamburger. And we have documentation that goes back to 1885, documentation in the forms of newspaper articles, in the forms of photographs. All of these things are on display at the museum, the Seymour Historic Museum, right downtown Seymour, on the burger grounds, on the Burger Festival grounds. All of these documents are on display there. So they go back to 1885, and there is no other community that can claim that their origins go back to 1885.
Hmm. Yeah, and in Texas, they have an approximation of the late 1880s, so you might have edged them out by a couple of years then.
Well, that's true, and again, you go with the approximation. We have dates of 1885. We have articles from the Outagamie County Fair that was happening that year and so on and so forth. So we have the documentation to back up our claim that Seymour, Wisconsin is definitely, without a doubt, the home of the hamburger.
Well, and you're celebrating that tomorrow at the 25th Annual Burger Fest. Can you tell us what to expect there tomorrow?
There is something for people of all ages. We have the 5K bun run, which starts off tomorrow morning for the adults and for the older runners. We have a kids bun run later on in the morning, right before the world's largest hamburger parade. And the world's largest hamburger parade begins at 11 a.m. And following the parade, at noon, the festival grounds open, and we go from noon to 9 o'clock on the festival grounds right downtown Seymour. And to get into the festival, it's $5 at the gate, but it's $3 for a button in advance. So today would be your day to get it in advance. And then in the evening at Rockledge Park, we have a hot air balloon rally And, of course, that is a beautiful sight if you've never been able to be a part of that. That is actually occurring this evening as well. It starts Friday night where they have, if weather permitting, the hot air balloons will ascend, and then they'll all come back, and at dusk they'll glow, which is awesome for the kids and all the families. And that is free of charge. And that, again, like I said, happens tomorrow night. But on the grounds we have bands, and we have burgers, of course. We have a Hardee's Thick Burger eating contest to see how many burgers you can eat in 10 minutes. We have a ketchup slide that is a hot attraction for so many people. It's like the old slip and slides from when we were kids, where you put the water on the slide and take a running start and see how far you can go. Well, instead of water, we put ketchup on this thing and take a running start and you take a head first dive and you try to set a new world record.
How messy.
Yeah, it is messy. And we have hoses to hose people down when they hop off the ketchup slide.
Great. Well, lots to do tomorrow, and people can learn more at homeofthehamburger.org, it looks like.
That is correct.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's been my pleasure, and we hope to see all of you out in Seymour this weekend.
That was John Steltz. He's Hamburger Charlie in Seymour, Wisconsin.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says the Western is losing the interest of American moviegoers, but we need Westerns now more than ever.
We'll talk to a popular mechanics writer who's asking, do we still need car dealerships in this country?